entrepreneurial roles really force you to, you know, like I said before, even about raising money, like seeing so much between the lines, understanding other people's motivations, being a better listener, you know, seeing the world as not just a mirror reflecting you, but, you know, thousands of mirrors reflecting everybody. And you're trying to take all of those signals in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto, and I'm the director of the Rosenman Institute at UCSF, the University of California, San Francisco. Today, we're talking to Jonathan Koh, founder and CEO of President Surgical, a startup based in San Carlos, California. President Surgical's technology is called CleanCision, which is an advanced irrigating wound protection system used during high-risk abdominal surgery to prevent surgical site infection. John's going to tell us about the lesson he has learned in his transition from engineer to CEO and the importance of having a mentor who guide him and somehow instill the advice in his mind all the time. John worked at Covidien for many years and later joined the Stanford Biodesign program. He founded President Surgical out of the program. At the time of this interview, they were in the middle of raising a $10 million Series B round. Late last year, they successfully closed the round with Baxter Ventures as their lead investor. If you like what you hear, subscribe on iTunes and enjoy the talk. The 2019 Rosenman Innovators application is now open. The selected innovators will receive coaching and mentoring, variety of in-kind services, and the opportunity to pitch in front of our early-stage investors network. Deadline to apply is Thursday, April 18. And for more detailed information, go to our website, www.rosenmaninstitute.org. Welcome, John. Thanks for joining me today at our podcast on a beautiful Friday. So you're the founder and CEO of President Surgical. Can you tell us more about the company?
What we do, yeah. So President Surgical really is a company founded by infection control experts, surgeons, and technologists to solve the problem of surgical site infections, which was a particular problem we observed when we were in the Stanford Biodesign program. We have a number of partnerships with different companies that we work on solving that problem with. And we've also developed our own proprietary CleanCision technology that really gets at the root cause of the infections to keep it clean, remove infectious contamination, and ultimately reduce the risk of developing an infection.
So do you have multiple products? Or you were saying that there's partnership with different companies?
Yeah, so I can't speak too much to the specific partnerships, but broadly, you know, there are a lot of health IT companies coming into play now where they're able to plug into the EHR systems to get patient data and then understand what patients' risks are, right? Now, although we are a surgical device, we don't necessarily advocate that our surgical device is used on all comers, right? And I think that's kind of the crux of the partnership is how do we do these pilots and understand and choose which patients get our technology to basically better deploy those resources within the operating room.
I assume this partnership evolved through with times.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so
yeah.
When did you do your Biodesign when this President Surgical got?
So Biodesign,
is this a project
taking me way back? Yeah, yeah. So 2011, 2012 is when I was an innovation fellow in the Biodesign program with three other team members. Jeremy Kaler was the other engineer, if you will, and then Insusa and Swami Nanashamagam were the surgeons. So we spent a lot of time in the OR. The focus area was infectious disease and immunology, so that kind of flavors or colors what we're looking into. And then naturally, we have two surgeons who are dragging us into the operating room. But we saw a kidney transplant patient where the surgeon was like, "Yeah, this patient's going to get an infection." You know, that was sort of old hat for the surgeons, but to Jeremy and I, it struck us as why is it in medicine today if you can predict a problem, you can't solve it, right? So that kind of piqued our interest. And really, as we dug into the opportunity further, it seemed one, I think, from a feasibility perspective, we could solve. We were developing a solid understanding of the disease state and the pathophysiology. And then ultimately, we came up with a pretty clever solution that, you know, I felt we can make the economics work out. You know, to be able to deliver the innovation to the medical field, but also deliver a return to our shareholders and other stakeholders.
I assume you have a lot of lists of unmet needs at that time. How do you come about to this one?
Well, I mean, there's sort of the boring answer, which is there's a lot of screening we do, right? So objective criteria, trying to give ratings to each of the criteria based on data, right? And I think that plays a large role of screening, you know, the first and second level screens. I think we kind of went back to our mission as a team when we started, and you also have to kind of overlay that with what your goals and objectives are for your career and life, right? And we knew at that stage we weren't going to be doing these big blue sky ideas, and we wanted to do something that we felt was near term, achievable, would be a great way for us ourselves to grow and really learn how to do it and use it as a springboard for the next one. So I think, you know, the final four we had, one was a need in pulmonary arterial hypertension, which we actually did form a company out of called Gradient Therapeutics. Swami's been leading that. Plantar fasciitis, which is a very interesting problem, but I don't think one in which we saw a feasible path forward. Raynaud's phenomenon, right, which was just, you know, it affects so many patients and is really incredibly interesting. We had some early prototypes or approaches that we tested in the Stanford Vascular Lab. You know, it just didn't work, right? You know, I think at some point when things don't work, it's time to move on. And it was very different with what became Prescient. You know, we were doing animal studies. We were bringing the concept out to surgeons. And, you know, pretty unanimously, people thought it was a clever idea. It was worthwhile. It should exist and had a really high probability of making an impact in the clinical problem. So that's less about putting it through an Excel spreadsheet and screen and more about, you know, keeping your head on a swivel, you know, getting feedback and really listening to it and trying to see qualitatively what you think bubbles to the top.
So you're working on multiple projects at the same time doing that?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, each of us sort of took the lead on those four projects. And then depending on our skill sets, we would kind of farm things out and say, hey, can you help with this? And meet weekly to kind of see, you know, which balls are being kicked furthest down the field. And I think that's another thing that I think comes into play, right? I mean, you only have a certain timeline you can work within, you know, to identify a new opportunity before you have to think about putting food on the table too, right? So, you know, we worked within those timelines. We set clear, I wouldn't say deadlines, but time points or checkpoints at which we said, look, roughly here's what we think we need to get done for each of these before we decide to continue investing resources, our time into working on them.
So all four of the team end up, I mean, participating in this Prescient Surgical?
Yeah. I think, from my understanding at BioDesign, that's not always the case. And I think, you know, we're very fortunate that we had each of us around the table bringing those different perspectives. You know, we're still close today. Swami's a cardiothoracic surgery fellow in Texas. I talked to him once a month, right? And he's evangelizing about our product in South Texas, right? So it's great to have friends in high places later on as you're trying to commercialize too, which I'm sure is something we'll get to later in this conversation.
So where is Prescient Surgical now? At what stage? I mean, you've done all that.
Where
are you guys at?
So we've done what I'd call prototype commercialization this year, right? I mean, that's actually really one of our core beliefs is, I wouldn't quite say fail fast. I mean, that's sort of the mantra of Silicon Valley. Ours was, before you spend a ton of time coming up with the answer that you think is the answer, try something, prototype it. And we started earlier this year with basically Jeremy and myself, right? Two co-founders formed the commercial team. You know, we had the knowledge about the product. We had the knowledge about the unmet need. And we were able to really position ourselves as solution providers. And we're commercial. So we have about a dozen customers around the country in a couple of key geographic areas. And we are in the middle of closing a Series B round that will fortunately allow us to hire professional sales reps, right? And we're going to, the first thing we're going to do is put them in those geographic regions where we've already seen some success and kind of let them get some traction and see how far they're able to build the business.
So you have your, you're in the middle of your financing round.
Yes. Yeah.
And congratulations, you got your lead.
Yeah.
And can you tell us more about that? What you can tell us?
Yeah. Sure. Well, I think one of, another thing we saw with this opportunity was by way of background, I had joined BioDesign after finishing up about 4 years working at Covidien. A couple of the last projects I worked on were deeply focused in abdominal surgery, and the top unmet needs that kept coming back were anastomotic leaks, surgical site infection, and within the context of an existing corporate, we ended up launching another product that is successful, but it is another version of what is effectively Covidien's cash cow, right? Ligasure. So I had already seen the need before, right? And then coming to BioDesign to see it firsthand, to actually witness this, it was another thing where I'm like, I'm not going to miss it this time. So I'm telling you that story because we always felt that there was a strong path to corporate partnerships here. So, I can't say who at this point, but we are pleased to announce that there will be a corporate leading the Series B. Strong validation of everything that we've been able to do up to this point. Great partnerships moving forward about piloting that commercialization. And ultimately, I think we see a broader partnership beyond once we're able to check the box and validate some key metrics that we're both looking for. And at the same time, like I mentioned, our four sales reps that we want to hire in our key geographies, it allows us to maintain our independence too, right? So sort of at least two paths forward. And I'm sure certainly more as we get down each of them simultaneously.
And how big is the round for this?
The round overall will be $10 million, and that's basically including some converting bridge notes that we had. The corporate's a significant portion of that, and then we're currently looking to fill out the syndicate.
That's great. And that's it's great always when you get that investor who is willing to lead.
Yeah, I think that's what,
journey.
Yeah, exactly. I think, it's hard as an operational guy, right? I'm a first-time CEO. I'm an engineer by training, engineer at heart, right? It's hard to fully understand just how much work fundraising it is and the fact that a CEO's full-time job is fundraising. Seems like that can't possibly be, enough of a job description to comprise a full-time job, right? But now, this is the third round I'm raising for Prescient. I've been involved in other raises. It absolutely is the truth, right? And I hope young budding entrepreneurs and CEOs are listening to that and may know it, but feel kind of empowered to say, this is what I'm going to spend 90% plus of my time doing. I've heard it from others. I've heard it from John, and I'm going to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So, being an engineer, do you feel that the training that you got helped you to do a lot of the fundraising, or you kind of learn it as you do it?
Well, yes and no, right? I think there are some huge advantages. I also think that, there are blind spots that it creates, right? So, financially, I don't have an MBA, but I think, I'm very comfortable with numbers. And, that was never a block for me to kind of take time to understand those things. I think, and on the flip side, though, I think we tend to be hyper objective, right? And that plays into how we tell stories. That plays into how we answer questions. And I think a lot of those soft skills of reading between the lines, of telling a story that's between the lines, I think those are skill sets that I've had to pick up along the way, and not without, you know, trips and falls in between, right? And another big piece of that is having good mentors around you who are, you know, able to point that out and communicate it to you in a way that, you know, you're able to learn from, right? And able to adjust your style.
I think that's something that is very important, but telling your story.
Yeah.
And there's a flaw. I mean, it's good to be objective, but I think when you tell the story, you need to get the vision to
be absolutely there. There's a piece of advice I got actually from mentor at Covidien, who's been involved with this for a long time and kind of related to that whole thing of all your time fundraising. You know, she checked in at one point. I'm like, you know, I just feel like all I do is PowerPoint. You know, all I do is tell stories, right? And she took a step back and she said, you know, there are very few lucky people who get paid a lot of money to only do that, right? And I think that's part of that validation again. I think come as an engineer, you have to be building something, right? You have to be delivering on something to create value. But as you say, painting that vision is what sets the stage for everything. It enables the engineers to go build something, right? The sales reps to go sell it, you know, your clinical and regulatory team to prove the value and get the approvals. If you can't tell the story, none of that follows.
I think sometimes being somebody who is engineer or practical is like you build something, you see it, the result right away. And then when you do a lot of more the telling the story, it's more intangible
until
the money shoots.
You see the results, you know, 2-3 years later or something like that, right? And you know, it's never truly done until the money's in the bank. And you know, there's not a lot of time to marvel over what you built, right? Because it's time to get back to work, right? So, and it's time to start thinking about the next fundraising round too, and where you're headed with it. So it's a very, very different job. It's a very different reward cycle. But it's one I didn't intend to ever do, but I love doing it. And I'm, you know, I view it now as empowering the great team I have of people that used to be like me to do the great work that they're able to do.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. So now if you tell your old self when you just started, what you learned now, what would you tell you that time that do this and don't do this?
I think one of them is just sort of the confidence of where you've been in the past is comfort and confidence that you'll get to where you need to go in the future, right? And I think that's one of the, you know, there are a lot of challenging times in any entrepreneurial venture, and I think that's one of the things I use to remind myself, right? And remind my team when they're you know, challenged by certain issues, that think of, you know, everything you've been able to do up to this point. You know, let's talk about some challenges that you've had. You nailed them. You overcame them, right? And I think we all too quickly forget the huge obstacles that we've surmounted. And I think that's what I would tell myself to really not sweat it, right? Is like, keep your head down, keep working. I guess keep your head up. I mean, it depends on, if you're an engineer, keep your head down on the desk and keep working. If you're, you know, if you're the visionary, keep your head up and keep forging forward. But the only way you have the confidence to do that is to remember where you came from.
And I think that sometimes it you have to go through the journey to achieve that too.
Yeah.
So you can't just shortcut. I mean, we always ask that question, like what you learned, can you tell your old self?
Yeah.
But then when your old self heard that, probably just like, I don't get it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, from a more tangible perspective, you know, there's a lot of insecurity that you have having not done it before, right? You know, and, you know, the first things I would think, I mean, I mentioned finance, right? I'd be like, well, I don't have an MBA. I don't know. I haven't really been in hardcore finance classes. Am I going to be able to do that part? You know, managing large teams, selling a vision, you know, do I have those skill sets? And, you know, when I meet with young entrepreneurs now, I think, or I tell them, don't worry about the skills you don't have, right? If you have a learning mindset, if you're dedicated to the vision, you're going to be able to figure them out. Now, it means that you're going to be spending probably a lot of nights after dinner, after the kids go to bed, you know, trying to learn from any source you can to create the output. And you may not be as efficient as someone who's been doing it for 10, 20 years, but you will absolutely get there.
Yeah, well, that's good. So you were working at, you mentioned working at Covidian, you mm-hmm. work at a large company. And then what inspired you? Like, I'm going to move to a startup. And how do you like that transition? And, you know, what's the like and what's not the like about being in a startup versus in a corporate America?
So funny story about that. It's my wife's fault, right? She's a physician. And, you know, I was working at J&J in Cincinnati after her intern year. She did a residency in Colorado, which had brought me to Covidian. And then she said, I don't want to stay here, right? I want to go do a fellowship at, you know, one of the top programs in the country. You know, at that time, to be quite honest, I was content at Covidian. I loved living in Colorado. You know, I spent most of my time mountain biking and ski mountaineering and skiing at the resorts.
Life was good.
It was a pretty good lifestyle, right? And I think there were some, you know, I, at the same time, it had been a lifelong goal to start a company, right? You know, it used to be as an engineer in grad school thinking, I'm going to probably invent some tech that I can push into the world, right? I saw a different view of that when I got into medicine, right? You saw so much of it was a surgeon's idea or, you know, some new disease space that we were going into. It really had nothing to do with the technology. And frankly, the technology was pretty low tech, right? Very happy in Colorado. I think that nagging piece was one, you know, if I never did anything, would I be able to, you know, fill that hole in my career with skiing? Yeah, probably. but naturally, because my wife was moving, you know, she ended up going to UCLA, and I had known about the biodesign program for, you know, 10 years at least at that point. So I said, if you're going to move to LA, you know, what I'd like to do is apply to the Stanford biodesign program, and or the rest from there is history.
So you she's in LA, you're here.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was 2 years of our marriage. Actually the first year of our marriage, we were basically apart, right? And while she was through med school, and then 2 years here. So we're used to it.
So sometimes you need other factor to push you to take on.
Yeah, right. There's a numeric, oh, this is gonna be super nerdy in engineering, but there's a numerical technique called simulated annealing, right? And you know what annealing is, right? You're slowly cooling things down so the crystals can, you know, find their maximum strength in the lattice, right? And I think of life kind of that way too. You know, sometimes we need, the way I think about it is like a relief map, and there are all these little ball bearings on the relief map, and you're trying to get to a point on that. And wherever you are today, though, there's some very significant like staying power in that, right? And just, you know, a difficulty to kind of, you know, some people might call it a rut. It doesn't always have to be a rut. It could be a very good place you're in, right? But if you have an idea you want to be somewhere else, the only way that's going to disrupt that is, you know, an earthquake on the relief map, right? Something that shocks it and sends you to some other spot on that map. So my wife has been that for me twice now. And, you know, I don't know what the future will hold, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there was something in her career again, that would force us both to look at where we are and where we want to go.
Or maybe you could be that one.
Maybe I could be that too. Yeah. So, I welcome the shocks, right? I think, you know, you can look at it as disruption, but, you know, with that simulated annealing piece, it's always like, hey, there's probably some higher maxima on this, you know, on this map somewhere, right? So let's take the shock and turn it into something, you know, go somewhere better, go higher, you know, achieve your goals, right?
Yeah. You're aware that I lost my late husband. Yeah. I noticed that we share something similar, but it's slightly different. Ferrell & Paul was your chairman of the board,
yeah.
And he died accident, a sudden. That must have made an impact. I mean, it does make an impact in my life and how I see the world and how I do things. How that make a difference?
To this day, it was a huge loss for me, my co-founders, and the company. You know, I think were she still with us today, I think we may be in, you know, a very different place now, you know, than we are today. I think it was a level of personal growth. I mean, I think one of the things I failed to mention before about starting the company, that was one of the factors that kind of came into play. And she was a co-founder. She was committed to our success. She invested her time. She invested her money. You know, the number one reason she did that was because of us. You know, just like I said, this is our vehicle for our growth. She saw what we could grow to, and that's why she was involved. And I can't tell you the number of back channel investor conversations she had that were part about the opportunity, but the other part was, you need to invest in the next generation of leaders so that we have an industry, right? So that we can continue to have this innovation that fuels the sales and marketing organizations in our healthcare system, right? So it was so much about us that we just felt, you know, that's another plus in the pros, a huge plus in the pros and cons side to have her there. And when she died, it was like a hole opened up. You know, and for a number of weeks, you know, and months, I think we had a good amount of momentum to keep moving forward. But I think, you know, our internal team, you know, we're like, where's the direction going to come from, right? And that was my job, and I think she prepared us well. I think she prepared me well, and you know, I still have. You know, her picture is sitting up in my office, and it's sort of more of an inspiration to me every day. And her little quotes or kind of affirmations or what I try to remind, in addition to, hey, you've been there before, so you're going to get there. You know, she just always encouraged us to do whatever it took to be successful and maintain your credibility, you know, as you're telling that vision story. So, yeah, it's tough to talk about because she was, we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for her. I wouldn't be a CEO if it wasn't for her. And I, you know, I still miss her every day with every meeting we go to, every debrief that I could have. I think of what she would say in her practical, matter of fact kind of way that is unfiltered. And that's the kind of advice that is so rare to come by. You know, and the best I could do is hope to carry on her tradition and help the next generation the same way she helped me.
I think sometimes we don't realize that the fact that you spend a lot of time with that person, it kind of ingrained in your brain. And oftentimes you do things, it caught you by surprise that, oh.
I mean, I'd have these Freudian slips, right? I mean, my wife's name is Carolyn. Farallon is Farallon, and I'd be home and I'd be calling my wife Farallon, right? So it's hard to describe with words just like how much a part of my life she was. And when she was taken from us, it was a big blow.
It's hard when you didn't expect that. And then all of a sudden everything changed.
Yeah.
When somebody's so crucial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the impact she had on others, you know, we were at the Fogarty Institute at that time. You know, Jeremy and I cried And, you know, you'd see everyone else who had come up and felt for us. And they'd, you know, we'd give each other hugs and they'd be crying too, right? I mean, you don't know quite the extent of someone's reach, unfortunately,
right?
Until they're gone, right? And
life is fragile.
It is, yeah. And I, at that time, I just had my first child, and I remember talking to one of our close consultants, and she said, go home. And I had to call everybody in the company. I had to let everybody know and go home and give that baby a big hug, right? And, you know, it's a reminder of how fragile life is. It changes your own outlook, as I'm sure it had for you with your husband. But also a reminder of how much impact you can have, right? If you play your life right.
Right.
So she's an inspiration, and she will remain an inspiration for me and for our team, you know, for years to come.
Yeah. No, that's great stories that you share about her.
So those are tough questions.
In terms of, so that experience and being entrepreneurs,
yeah,
has, how that experience has make you a better person. I mean, we all want to be a better person. And what,
yeah,
kind of piece that make you feel that?
You know, for me, I think it's been a journey inside out, right? And, you know, I always wondered how old people knew so much, right? As a child learning from them, or even as a young adult, and now even, right? You know, if I were to kind of describe the phases of what I went through growing up, was, you know, sort of self-actualization as like a first step, you know, finding something you're passionate about, learning how to do it, and being able to set your mind to doing it, right? Sort of step one. And that could be a part of a larger group or a very group-oriented project. It also can be a very solo endeavor. And I think the roles in which I played, it was, you know, largely a solo endeavor early on. You know, then I think if you're lucky, you kind of get into this a little more of a self-aware stage, right? Where you kind of understand what your position and place and how you fit into the larger machinery, right? You know, and I think I was a great individual contributor, right? And I was happy, fulfilled doing that. And I think entrepreneurial roles really force you to, you know, like I said before, even about raising money, like seeing so much between the lines, understanding other people's motivations, being a better listener, you know, seeing the world as not just a mirror reflecting you, but, you know, thousands of mirrors reflecting everybody. And you're trying to take all of those signals in. So it's a bigger world. It's expanded the world for me. And I think, you know, what I'm trying to do is to continue to be open to it as much as I possibly can.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. So you mentioned you did a lot of, in the beginning, a lot of solo journey, and also fundraising can be a very lonely journey. And how do you keep on at it when things are tough? Do you have...
Yeah. Well, I'll one-up you on that, right? I mean, venture capitalists are nicer than customers in hospital systems, right? So...
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, venture capitalists, I mean, there's a great code, you know, investors... You know, I personally haven't really had any negative experience with investors, right? I found, you know, it's a professional business. They're polite. They're so used to seeing so many of these that, you know, doesn't pay to be mean. And also, you know, who wants their character to be influenced by being mean to every 100 pitches they see every
right.
day? So, I mean, honestly, I found that to be a very professional group of people. You know, hospitals, on the other hand, not that they're unprofessional, right, but they're so busy. And, you know, my wife, as a physician, describes it as swimming they're swimming in the pool, just barely treading water, and you're on the side of the pool with a new technology, a new idea, and you're saying, "Come on, just like swim over the side of the pool, and we'll show you how much this will improve your ability to stay afloat," right? And that's where the stress kind of comes into play. I think that's where you can take the professionalism, and it will bare teeth at some time. So those moments have been very disheartening, really, right? Especially coming from a program like biodesign, where you know that the patients, the hospitals, the physicians need it, but there's a energy barrier there that's preventing them from being able to adopt it, or be able to say yes, or even just being able to carve out time to learn more. So it's not just a hit on a personal level. It's sort of like this, looking out to the world, you see that part of the world, not just what you need to do, which is get your technology adopted. You're seeing the challenges that exist in the system. And again, I'll go back to, you've done hard things before, right? And just be persistent. Listen to others, adjust your approach. And, I think the past 6 months for us have been validating that we can do it. You know, two engineers with zero prior sales experience, you know, we've been able to be on a monthly run rate that, you know, we'd be able to actually hang our hat, as sales reps, right? You know, I think we'd actually be able to make it as sales reps with the amount of revenue we've been able to bring in, the amount of time we've been able to do it. So it's just another mountain to climb. Mm-hmm. And if you've climbed 20 others, you have to say, is this one really different? Slightly different, different approaches, but they're still just mountains.
So you started your career as engineer, and mm-hmm. I often, some kids, I was like, "Oh, I want to be an engineer." Were you those kind of kids?
No. I went, not as a kid, no. I grew up in a very small town in upstate New York. And, I don't think many people knew what an engineer was, and certainly not, nor did I.
What's your background like? What's your family background?
My dad's a contractor. So I used to work with him, framing houses, doing finished work. So, I was always capable with my hands. And my mom was, a school assistant. And, I think for my dad, I learned, he ended up starting his own contracting business when I was probably early teen years or so. So I saw the customer, not just the technical piece, but what it took to find customers, to make sure you were getting estimates, following up with the work after it was complete to make sure, the customers were satisfied. I did well in school, and I think that at that point the question is what next. And most people were going to college, but then what are you going to college for? And I think you rely on your teachers who say, you'd probably be good in engineering because you've done well in math and you like science, right? So you take the advice of the people who know you best, right? And it's a great thing about going to school like that. I mean, my teachers knew me from when I was 4 years old, right? So they knew everything about me, the good, the bad, the ugly. And I think my teachers and the town as a whole, I mean, did a good job to make sure they shepherd people like me and a lot of other people that I went to school with into the right places.
It's amazing how important that is. And not everybody are fortunate enough.
I know. Yeah, we didn't have, there wasn't a lot we had, right? I mean, small town, not a lot of resources, but I think that was one thing that we did have, which was that supportive community to make sure, no one was really left behind.
Yeah, I think as long as we keep on doing that, I think the world will be fine.
I think so, yeah. Be kind to each other, help them.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So moving on to the fun stuff.
Okay, what's the fun stuff?
Share your top three advice that you heard from other that you keep going back at. Maybe that's just not so fun, but this is something that I think would be helpful for a lot of people to hear.
So my favorite, you know, you probably know Tom Crummell, right? Tom has some of my favorite one-liners for things. And one of them that always stuck with me, which is sort of like the procrastinator's creed, right, is never do something today that you can put off until tomorrow because you'll be smarter tomorrow, right? You know, and I think a lot of people can dismiss that as a procrastinator's creed, right? But I think what I've learned in this position is another way of saying that is don't spend money at risk, spend money to reduce risk, right? And I mean, that's something that I think most any business leader would agree with, right? But in a lot of ways, they're one and the same, right? Don't just do something because it seems like it's the next thing to do. And I like to think of things and breaking them down that way. Am I spending the money at risk? I'm just doing something today because it's today. We need to do something. Or is the money I'm proposing being spent to reduce some downstream risk, right? Either retire a risk or cover an exposure that you might have. So that's one I think about a lot. If you talk to anyone on my team, they know.
You always ask that question.
I always ask, what's the upside, right? And it, to me, it's sort of those decisions that you're making, you need to make a good decision where the upside outweighs the downside, and you need to be making that decision at the right time. Is that upside still achievable in 1 month, 2 months, 3 months? Is it mitigating some risk, or is that upside that you're doing, does that come with some crazy downside exposure, right? I mean, I'm not an MBA, so I don't do four blockers, but I imagine there's some kind of like four blocker that you could put that in, right? And I think it's especially critical in startups because we're always faced with this artificial time's up. So you have to be, you know, that's why that advice is so important, because you really need to think about, within the window I have, should I be doing that now or should I be doing that later? And then the context in which we make that decision is it spent at risk, or is it spent to reduce risk? That's sort of, mm-hmm. sort of like all you need to know, I think, right? I
mean, okay.
It's sort of.
I hope that doesn't cover the three.
It doesn't.
What is the other two?
Other two. I know you interviewed Josh McHour, right? And I think early on starting Prescient and Gradient, and I was involved in another company called Medivention, where I was making a lot of personal decisions. And, you know, his advice was always do the big things, because the big things are just as hard as the small. Now, I don't think that would have changed the direction I was headed, but I do think it's a great kind of screen or filter to think about the opportunities you're choosing to pursue, right? Because it's all life, right? It's all hard, right? Whatever, you know, they're going to be easy steps for some startups, and that will just uncover harder steps down the line. And I think in my experience, that advice has been entirely true to form. You know, a lot of our decision-making around this was like, this is feasible, it's contained, you know, pretty straightforward regulatory and clinical proof paths. But it's been a long road for us, right? We've come up against some very significant external challenges, right? And oftentimes, those are the hardest ones to solve, you know, versus you pick, you know, percutaneous heart valves or something. You can say, well, shoot, you know, the engineering behind that must be so hard. But the learning is, I'll take any challenge that is within my control or my team's control over those externalities that can come up. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid of those big, hard problems that you have to solve.
Okay. Well, that's good.
That's two, so I have to come up with that third one.
The third one, yeah. Okay. Somehow three is a good number.
Yeah, the rule of threes, which I mainly know as a comedy thing, right? So, maybe I have a note here. Let's see. Oh, yeah, there are a couple others. So, fast versus good. So I taught, right, money spent at risk, money spent to reduce risk. Fast versus good. And I think you want to consciously ask that question. And it relates to another, which is just remember, goals are never implicit. And Farallon's advice was always, she was always like, well, is that what you think you can do? Or the team thinks they can do? I'm like, yeah, I think, you know, we kind of put the Gantt chart together and the budget. And she's like, I would double it, or I would bring it in by 3 months. I'm like, I don't know that that's feasible. And she's like, always push people to do more than they think they can do, because she's like, 9 times out of 10, they will get there. And that was a completely different mindset than what I had been taught in corporate, right? I mean, you are measured, you're rewarded based on hitting some arbitrary time point that you decide upon, right? And that philosophy, I think, fits well with my personality, right? I mean, I love driving things forward, and I think most entrepreneurs do. So to have that, license, you know, given to me by Farallon to say, no, it's okay to ask people to do hard things, way harder than they even intended them to be, because that's what we're trying to do as entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that since in every leader I've had the privilege of working with. You know, you'll come up with a plan, and then they come into the meeting and they're just trying to push things forward. What if we did it this way? And that, they don't have the domain expertise, but they're pushing you to think about it in different ways. That's what fundamentally, and I think in a medical device startup, that's what the role is. Because it is very easy to get locked into, well, it's a medical device company. You develop your prototype, you put in an animal, then you do, you get your regulatory submissions ready, first in man, then you do clinical studies, reimbursement. I mean, it can be thought of as a very step-by-step process, which will bring a lot of engineers and objective thinkers to the table, but you're not going to be exceptional if you don't push people off of that straight and narrow path.
It forced people to be creative as well.
Yeah. And we've had, I mean, I think those are probably the most fun, meetings that we've had as a team, but they will also tell you they're like the most anxiety inducing, right? When I do, we're doing a whiteboard meeting to talk through our plan for one project or another, you know, I see the faces in the room because they know what I'm going to be doing, right? Mm-hmm. But I think everyone comes out of it and says, well, we got to where we wanted to be faster. We scaled the mountain faster, right? Or we got there where we might otherwise not have. And I think that's the validation that everyone gets to see about why we do it.
Do you give your team, in terms of like why they need, I mean, of course we want to do everything faster, but why need to be faster? Because otherwise they'd be frustrated.
Yeah. No, I mean, we're a very small team, remember, right? We've, like, at our peak, I think we've only been like 7 full-time employees, and usually have like a shout out to Purdue, because Jeremy's a Purdue alum. We almost always have at least one Purdue co-op in the office, and they've been fantastic. We're very flat, and I've been open with everybody. I mean, almost nothing is a secret, and it's only a few times where I have to say, hey, all that stuff I've been telling you, you cannot tell anybody about it. And the reason why is because of its strategic importance, right? I think the next gig, may try to more formalize that with myself, because I think there could be some pluses and minuses to it. But the pluses this time have far, far outweighed any negatives, because it makes for a team that's willing to rally around any challenge that's put out there.
Okay. Well, that was my last question.
Awesome.
And well, thank you this for joining me.
That this is great. Amazing. These are very thought-provoking questions, and all part of the reflection process. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you.